At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
I tuoi nuovi clienti stanno ascoltando questo spot pubblicitario in questo preciso momento. Cosa diresti loro della tua attività se potessi farlo? L'SBS è l'emittente più affidabile di tutta l'Australia. I nostri ascoltatori sono fedeli, altamente partecipi e da sempre sostengono una miriade di aziende locali. Fai che la tua sia la prossima. Offriamo pacchetti pubblicitari per aziende di ogni dimensione. Il nostro team esperto di vendita ti guiderà lungo il processo di una favolosa campagna pubblicitaria. Portaci tu il tuo spot oppure incarica il nostro team di produzione di realizzartene uno in una delle nostre 68 lingue. Cosa aspetti? Inizia oggi stesso la conversazione col tuo nuovo pubblico. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
Siete in compagnia di SBS Italian. Trovate altre storie su sbs.com.au/italian o scaricate la SBS Radio app.
You're listening to SBS Italian e to an SBS Italian podcast, I'm Magica Fossati. Today I'm in the studio with Karen Ingram. Welcome to SBS.
Thank you, Magica.
And James Panichi.
Thank you, Magica.
Welcome or benvenuto. James and Karen don't share the same surname, but they are actually family. And this is the amazing story that they come to share with us. I'll start with Karen, because Karen, you grew up in a family where you knew, I guess, from the beginning that you were adopted.
Correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you grew up and when your curiosity for your family, biological family, started?
Well, I don't remember not knowing. I guess when I was about three, my mother told me, I was on a swing in a playground, and she did tell me then that I have another mummy and that she couldn't keep me and that my mum and dad waited a long time for me to come to them. They were on a list for 7 years waiting for a baby girl. They had two other sons that were 10 and 12 years older than me, but they wanted me, they chose me. A lot of adopted people have hear the same story. It was like there was the same pamphlets going around in the 1960s for adoptive parents to be able to say, I chose you, you're so wanted, and you're special. So those things were always repeated a lot in my growing up. Yeah.
And that's a very special message to grow up with, I guess.
It is. It is. And I always felt very loved and accepted. But also, I was always interested in family history, so I would talk to my grandparents and aunties and just want to know about the olden days and what was it like and who was your mother and what did you do when you were a little girl. And so I was always interested in the olden days and where people come from. So I did adopt their family history as my own. My father, adoptive father, Ian, he was from Scottish heritage, so there was a lot of, you know, very pride on, you know, the Forbes family name and the tartan and the motto, and we had all of that, so I soaked that all up as my own.
So they gave you a very rich background, I guess. But
yes.
When did you start feeling that you also wanted to know a little bit more about your biological family history, and what did you know to begin with?
All I knew in the beginning was that her name was Anne, and that is my middle name. That was my birth mother's name. And then when I was about 8 years old, my mum told me that she had some paperwork, you know, in an envelope, and that, in fact, my father was Italian. And I was devastated.
Why was that so?
I'm sorry to say, especially to the Italian people listening. I grew up in Newcastle, a very Anglo-oriented city in New South Wales, north of Sydney, and I did not know any people other than Anglo people.
So that was an additional layer of otherness, I
yes,
guess.
Yes, there was definitely otherness. And the only people that I did know, who I thought were Italian, were Maria and Tony from the fish and chip shop.
And who turned out not to be Italian.
No, they end up being Greek. But anyway, at the time, as a little girl, I just thought, oh, no, you know, I don't want to have gold teeth and frizzy hair like Maria and Tony at the fish and chip shop. And that's all I had to go on. So obviously when I moved to Melbourne and I started to, you know, meet more Italian people and just fell in love with the fact that I thought I was half Italian. That was what I was really excited about. In terms of meeting my birth mother, I was very conscious of what that would mean for my mum. And so I was always tiptoeing around that.
So you were aware of the sensitivity for your
Absolutely.
Adoptive parents as well?
Yes. Mm. So I was probably 27 when my mum said to me in Melbourne in the city and about to cross the road in Collins Street and she just said, would you like to find your birth mum? Shall we look for Anne? And I just went, yes. And then the lights went green and we crossed the road. And so she was fantastic, which I did not expect.
What a special moment and what great support for you to start a quest.
Yes, it's been quite a quest.
We are talking to Karen Ingram, who's also the author of a book inspired by her search for her biological roots, I guess, Lifting the Lid. And that's a story that you published not long ago when you had kind of found out about half the story.
Yes.
What did you know?
Well, it sort of ends on a cliffhanger, if you like, where I had thought, so I had met my birth mother, my half-siblings, aunties, my grandmother, cousins, and so it's a search for them and meeting them and living, knowing them. And then when I started to look for my father, which I had been warned about by my birth mother. She gave me a name. And
like a first name, or did you have a surname as well?
We had a surname, but I misheard it. So I was going down the wrong path for a little while. And then I have an Italian deli around the corner from my house, Rocco and Adriana, and they were really interested in my story, and so they helped me say, like, you've got the name wrong, that doesn't make sense. So then I went back to the electoral rolls, and anyway, it was just a long quest investigating, you know, who this man could be. And I ended up meeting that man, and he accepted that I could be his daughter, and we, you know, fell in love, and I introduced my children, and then I had agreed, of course, to do a DNA test, and it wasn't him. So that was
a
horrible
false path you went down.
Yeah.
That must have been devastating for you.
It was devastating. So then I started looking around, and around that time I said to my birth mother, it's not him. And so that began the big freeze, I guess. I was sort of frozen out of the family. So all of the ties were cut from my maternal side, who we'd been reunited happily for 19 years. I met her the night before my wedding. You know, all of that's in the book. It was all fabulous for a long time until it wasn't, and then it was awful.
That's very sad, and I guess very difficult for someone like yourself who's been actively looking
yes.
for her biological family.
Yes.
To hit such a major roadblock, I
yes.
guess.
Yes. And then after, you know, dealing or not dealing so well with that, I just thought, well, if I must be more like my father, because I would never do that. I could never. So that's why I thought, well, if I'm like my father, he would want to know me. And so that's what compelled me to keep on going.
What did your biological mother tell you, apart from that name that wasn't really clear?
Well, when she found out that it wasn't him, because she believed that it was, and then she just said, well, the only other man I was with at the time used contraception. And so that's why I guess she thought it was the other guy. But then she would not tell me any more information. And that was it, the end.
That would have been really hard for you to process and accept, I guess. So did you publish the book thinking, I'll give it a rest, let's see what happens? Or were you still actively looking?
I was still actively looking. I had a couple of other DNA tests. I wrote a few more letters. I wrote letters to people in Italy that I had a friend who was in Italy at the time. He looked up the phone book looking for this name. So none of them gave me my answers. But a long time before that, before I was looking specifically for one person, I wanted to just be sure that I was Italian, that I did have Italian ancestry. So I did my own DNA test, and then that just sat there. It just came back saying, yes, you are Italian or half Italian. So that was great. So I was happy with that until it wasn't enough for me.
We're speaking to Karen Ingram and also James Panichi, who meanwhile, did you know anything about this?
I knew absolutely nothing. I have an Italian father, an Anglo-Celtic Australian mother, and the assumption had always been that it was just me and my sister Louisa, who now lives in Italy. And that's all there is to that part of the story. We knew nothing, had absolutely no idea of anything, of the possibility even of having another sibling.
But something pushed you to decide to have a DNA test as well. But I guess it was just out of curiosity about your background.
Yeah, so it was one of the DNA kits that you can get from international companies. And it actually started because I'd mentioned to my sister-in-law that I was particularly interested in a certain part of the Italian family. And that is, my father was born in Venice, although his father was Tuscan. But the Venetian side of the family, they always had a particularly sort of Slavic look. And I know that's probably very politically incorrect, but they sort of looked sort of rather, there was part of the family that was tall and sort of had sort of strange high cheekbones. They didn't look particularly Italian, for whatever that means nowadays. And so I thought I'd be really interested just because of Venice's rich history around the Mediterranean, the fact that they'd colonized all parts of the Mediterranean, so there'd been a big exchange of culture and through trade, and particularly through the Greek-speaking world. So I thought I'd be really interesting. So one Christmas, we have a KK system, a Kris Kringle system in the family, in which everyone buys one nice present for another member of the family, and you know how it goes. That's why, in fact, I sometimes refer to Karen as KK, just because it's a good reminder for me of a sort of a Kris Kringle present. So my sister-in-law gave me this present, but there'd been a mistake. One member of the family had two presents, so we thought, oh, we'll give it to my brother-in-law who didn't have a present, and he looked at it and he said, oh, yeah, but probably not as interested as James is. Why don't you have it? And I said, are you sure? So anyway, we went backwards and forwards to cut a very, very long story short. Yes, a very long story short. I took the test and the results came back. And, you know, initially I just, because I wasn't looking for any personal connection, I just looked, you know, they give you a little map of a breakdown of the map. And the map wasn't particularly precise, I must say. And it's since then, obviously with more data, it's become slightly more precise. But eventually it sort of settled on, whatever it is, in my case, 40% Northern Italy. The rest was a bit of France. The rest was a bit of, they just said the Balkans. So that suggested probably Croatia or Slovenia, and a little bit of Germany. And that's all pretty typical for a northern Italian, particularly a Venetian. So there are no major surprises. And I must say that I just put aside the results and didn't go back to them for another couple of months, I think. Then I went back and I realised that there was actually a thing that they show matches in. They sort of match you with people. And there are some people whose family names, particularly on my mother's side of the family, I know there's some family sort of amateur historians, and I recognise their names. But there was also a Karen Ingram. Now, I thought, oh, then just partly because my mother's side of the family is very Scottish, Ingram sounded Scottish, I said, look, it's got to be one of my cousins who's used a, you know, a nom de plume or changed their name for whatever reason. And so I didn't think that much of it. But then I did a bit of research, I did a bit of Googling, and I found Karen's website, and in which she talks about her story of adoption. So I thought, oh, I wonder what's going on here. So it's still the penny hadn't dropped, but I got in touch with my sister, who my other sister, who now lives in Italy, and I said, oh, look, this is a bit unusual, but I'm going to reach out to this person. So I reached out to Karen, and we had an initial phone call. I can't quite remember. It feels like so long ago, although it's only really a few years ago. We had an initial phone call, and we talked it through, and I was, well, I mean, overwhelmed in a positive way. There are no negatives to this story, but it's just something, if you had no idea that this is something that was out there. I mean, if I'd had even an inkling, if there were rumours in the family, if my father had had the, you know, reputation of being a bit of a Don Giovanni or a sort of a bon vivant who was who was meeting women left, right and centre, but he certainly didn't. So this was, and also the fact that when Karen told me that she was in fact from New South Wales originally, my father had lived all of the time since arriving in Australia in 1960. He'd lived in Melbourne. I didn't think he'd even been to Sydney.
It didn't add up to you.
It didn't add up. But you know, we took a subsequent DNA test, and the evidence was conclusive. So so then we started going about sort of the long but very rewarding process of getting to know each other, getting to know each other's families, and just building from that.
Your father was still alive then?
Yes, he was, yes.
How did you break the news to him? Because, you know, you had a conversation between the two of you.
Yes.
How did you talk to him about it?
Well, my father, whose name was Gino, he died a year and a bit ago now. It was hard because he was already suffering from vascular dementia, so he was not quite, he wasn't totally present, and his memory had just gone. So he still remembered now. We've got to talk about, this is an important part of the story, but we'll get to it. But he had this very unusual trip up north once in 1964. And I was trying to ask him about that trip that he took, but he couldn't quite remember it. But we'd heard about this trip all of our lives, so because it was a fascinating, absolutely fascinating time in a way, in Italian-Australian history, where he'd been sent north in his car. He had a Volkswagen Beetle. So it's not the kind of car that you would necessarily want to drive very long distances in. But he drove up, and he'd been sent by the Italian newspaper in Melbourne called Il Globo. He'd been sent up to go through all of the Italian communities in eastern Australia, along the eastern Australian coast, find towns in particular that weren't big enough to stock, the news agency wasn't large enough to stock the Italian newspapers, and to sell subscription. So he was up travelling up north selling subscriptions. Now, the part of this story, so what he did is he went to all small country towns in Victoria, New South Wales, in which there are very large Italian communities, you know, many of them working as farmers. And he would just show up at the local pub, introduce himself and just say, look, where do Italians meet? Where do they get together? And so they'd always point out something. So he'd just be knocking on doors selling subscriptions. So he'd been in Australia at that stage. He arrived in 1960, so he'd been here for 4 years. He was always after the next big thing. You know, he was always trying to imagine himself a very successful businessman. And this was his and he was, in truth, a very good salesman. He had a very good relationship with people that he had to sell things to. And so he thought, well, this could be great. It turned out not to be great financially. He always told the family that he lost a lot of money because he was working on commission and his car broke down time and time again, so he had to get it repaired. By the end of the trip, the car could no longer go. But anyway, all he could remember of that was that he stopped in Sydney on the way there, on the way back, but there was nothing for him to do in Sydney, as he said it, because at that stage Il Globo and the Sydney newspaper La Fiamma were still competing against one another, so he couldn't sell subscriptions in Sydney. So he just kept on going. But he said, oh, yeah, I would have gone to meet Italian community, to Italian community functions, just to see what was going up. And then the part of the story which he'd always talked about all through our childhood was he drove all the way to northern Queensland, so all the way to Townsville, and then he'd driven his little Volkswagen all through the...
which would have been quite an adventure.
It was
then.
An extreme adventure, and I think he'd misjudged the distances. I think he'd probably thought that going from Melbourne to Townsville was like, you know, Rome, Milan.
As
you know,
many Italians do.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I came to Australia the first time, and, yeah. I thought I was going to have a round Australia trip within a month.
Yeah, it does. It's not. And people, I think Italians just don't understand the distances. But anyway, that was an absolutely fascinating time for him, and he'd always remembered that. And, you know, part of, you know, whenever he'd get together, he would always say, oh, have I told you about the time that I went up to Queensland? And he talked about visiting these Italian cane cutters. Many of them were from the Veneto region, so he spoke Venetian as his first language, so they were speaking dialect together. And he was just visiting all of these cane cutters, some in very remote communities. Some of them he found, you know, desperate to talk, very, very lonely, desperate to make some kind of a connection, probably easy for him to sell a subscription to, I'd imagine. But he'd always talked about this one Venetian cane cutter who had married a local indigenous woman, and about talking about these little Aboriginal kids who were speaking Venetian to him, which he thought was fantastic insight into Australia. And so this trip had always been part of the family folklore, but the Sydney component of that had long been forgotten because he didn't think it was particularly noteworthy, and he obviously had absolutely no idea that Karen existed.
Karen, can you remember when you got the call from James?
Sure can. It's burned into my memory bank. Well, it was actually an email, and I was in Newcastle because my book had been launched 2 weeks before. And I was in Newcastle visiting my parents. It was my dad's 90th birthday. But I'd also lined up some radio interviews in while I was away. So I went into ABC studios. I was also doing phone interviews with Melbourne Radio as well. And, you know, showing my family here are copies of my book. And that was all very exciting. And then I remember being, I know exactly where I was standing with my daughter and my husband, and an email came through from this James Panici. And it said, oh, hi, I've just got my DNA results, and I have a very strong percentage, and I'm just wondering who you are, who you might be. And so I just went, oh, my God, this is it. And I didn't – it was our last day in Newcastle, and we were flying home later that night, so I thought I'll just, you know, focus on my family, not get carried away. And then at the airport in Newcastle that night at the bar, I replied to James saying, well, I'm adopted. I was born in 1965. I believe my father is Italian. That's about it. That's who I am. That's why I've probably come up in your DNA results. And then the next day, because it was, the next day was a Monday the 8th of March, which was International Women's Day.
Which year?
2021. And it was also the 8th of March was the day that I was adopted, the date that I arrived in my Forbes family. It was also the date that I found my birth mother. So that was all a bit spooky. And so James and I had arranged to have a conversation on the phone, and I think we spoke for almost 2 hours. I remember sitting on my lounge, and my husband was next to me, and all he could hear me saying was, he was born in Venice. What? And his father's from Tuscany, and my family are all around me going, what? Oh, my God. So there was much excitement, and, yeah, we had a lot to talk about. And that's when we were saying, James was questioning, well, actually, he was never in Sydney, and maybe your mother was in Melbourne. It's like, no, she never went to Melbourne. And so we had a bit to work out. And then, you know, we're quite happy to, well, James was going to speak to Gino to see, you know, let him know, well, there's this person, and how about doing a DNA test, which he agreed to, but there's more to that story. And so we didn't sort of go public with it until that DNA result had come back.
When you were really
and
sure.
There were lockdowns as well happening at that time, and then there was Easter, so the results seemed to take forever to come back. And then James rang me as soon as he got the news.
Yes.
How was it for you?
Well, it was, I mean, again, it's the kind of thing that even to this day you takes a while to get your head around. I mean, it's obviously a different experience for Karen, who's known since a child that there was a possibility of having this other family. In our case, we didn't know anything about it. In fact, my mother is died before this, and I asked my aunt, and I just said, look, my father, before he met my mother, obviously my father met my mother, I think almost a year after this trip to trip up north.
Yeah, so there's no overlap.
There's no, yeah, not yeah. That, I mean, I've reached the stage of my life where I don't have the emotional energy to be judgmental about my father's life. But no, there was no, I mean, he hadn't met my mother. My mother was still living in Japan where she was working at the time. But I asked an aunt of mine who's, you know, knew all the family gossip. I said, did you have any idea this could have been a possibility? And she said, no. She said, I mean, if anyone would have known, it would have been her. But she said, no, absolutely not. And my father, too, who loves... I mean, this has been my father's been, by all means, a flawed individual and not perfect in the way that none of us are perfect. But he was always a very, very loving parent. It's hard to imagine my father knowing about having a child and not wanting to be involved. I'd find that very, very difficult to accept. So there was genuinely no sense of him knowing that Karen was out there. And for us, having spent all of our lives, myself, me and my sister Louisa, who now lives in Italy, we'd always seen ourselves as, you know, the two children of the family. We'd this kind of thing, it does take a while to get your head around. And even now, it's not difficult and it's not unpleasant. It's all good, but it does take you a while because you haven't grown up together. Mm. It does take a while for you to make sense of the fact that you now, in fact, have another sibling.
I imagine that the first meeting in person was probably a little bit challenging, very special. But as you were saying just now, there's not that shared past and the shared history. Mm. So a lot of catching up to do.
Mm.
How has your relationship developed since?
Well, I think it would be good just to acknowledge that day we first met and just to see James in real life, and also the drive. My husband, Andrew, drove me to Carlton, and James had said, let's meet at the University Cafe. Yep. Which was a favourite haunt of Gino's. And so even the drive there, I was very nervous and also a bit of, you know, I've done this before and I thought it was all going to be fine, but it fell apart. But my husband was saying, no, you've got the DNA now. You know, this is it. So I was excited and, yeah, just James was there when I arrived and it was incredible. And looking into, I stared, hopefully not in a creepy way, but I could not stop looking at you, and it was emotional and very exciting, and we just told each other about our families. But the other unusual thing, I guess, in these biological reunions is, or meetings for the first time, was that James had been down to readings to buy two copies of my book before we met, and he's like, you know, I said, well, that's my story.
Like, yeah, that's you right. Can go- I'm helping you to move some units.
Yeah, so, that's you know, right. Yes, yeah. He was happy to promote my my book. But that was a beautiful thing. And he bought a copy for himself and one for our sister, Louisa.
Beautiful. Mm. And then you met Gino as well.
Yes. So that was another fantastic day. Gino, well, yeah, he agreed to meet.
He's very happy. I mean, I should say that my father, whose dementia was real at that time, he'd always been very sharp. But he was still his personality was still the same. He was still very jovial. But he just couldn't quite make sense of the idea of having a daughter. But he could tell that she was one of the family. He'd often say that. He says, I can tell you're one of us. You're one of us. But I think in his mind it was like a long-lost niece. He just couldn't quite make sense of it. But that said, he was delighted, absolutely delighted to meet Karen.
So Gino was at James's house that day and I went over and, yeah, so that drive over, it's all the letters I've written and dropped in mailboxes or the drives I've had towards a meeting of some sort. There's been quite a few of those. So I was excited and he stood up there's a beautiful photo that James took of us like walking towards each other and holding hands and looking into each other's eyes. And he did say, "This is incredible. I look at you and I see me. I see me in you." And it was fantastic. And although James does say that there'd been a decline in Gino's mental capacity, you know, I guess I didn't know Gino before then, so I had nothing to compare it to. So for me, meeting Gino, like, he was everything and more. He was present. He recognised me as family, and that was the best thing. And then times after that, like, I was probably hanging on to James to initiate other follow-up visits with Gino just so that he didn't feel too confused. But then I got to the point where I would go and meet with Gino and we'd go out to a cafe or I'd sit in his room and we'd talk and I'd listen to his stories because James, I think, had heard all of his stories.
Yes, 100 times.
He needed a new audience, so I was happy to hear all of the stories. And then he would occasionally say to me, "I'm so sorry, I don't remember. I don't remember, you know, who she was or anything like that." And it's like, "That's okay. It was a long time ago. You're 91. Like, I'm sure there'll be things that I don't remember when I'm lucky enough to live to 91. So I understood that that was confusing because he had no recollection and it would have been, you know, an event, you know, that happened and then off he went in whatever direction, either to Townsville or back to Melbourne. We don't know if it was on the way up or on the way back, but it happened.
Very special, though, that he could meet him in person.
Yes.
And spend that time
yes.
with him.
Yes, and I think James has just confirmed what I had originally said, that I must be like my father because he would want to know me. And just the way that, you know, James just described Gino as a very loving father and that if he had have known that there was a child, he would definitely want to know. So that was really affirming for me and to know more about Gino and who he was, and all the photos came flooding in and he was a beautiful man that I'm very proud to now know that he was my father.
That's a special story, incredible, and just hearing about it, I can't imagine living through it. But you were saying before that you've kept up your relationship, it's kept developing, your families have met each other. How is that for both of you?
It's fantastic. It's beyond positive. I do have some sympathy for other families who have been through this, in the sense that you don't quite know how these things will work out. You don't know if personality wise you'll be compatible. You don't know. You know, there might be elements that you can't quite reconcile. But in our case, it's been incredibly positive. And I mean, you don't know, getting along with someone, you don't know the extent to which it's a genetic thing and the extent to which it's just because Karen had lovely adoptive parents. It might be a mixture of both, or just one or the other. I don't know. But we certainly get along extremely well. I mean, we come from a family. The Italian side of the family is very gregarious, very chatty, very communicative, and, you know, also very, very sort of irascible and prone to temper tantrums as well. So not perfect, but it is. We seem to be getting along extremely well. Karen's family is absolutely fantastic. Her children are lovely, creative. Everything that we recognise in the Paniki family as sort of a family trait, just because my father had 12, he was one of 12 brothers and sisters, so it's a very large family. All of them seem to be artistic to some extent, although my father was the one member of the family who had no artistic inclinations at all. So it is just, I do recognise a lot of ourselves in Karen's family. I don't know how much of that is me projecting, how much is of it is genetic, but it is something that makes me feel comfortable. My sister in Italy, Louisa, feels very comfortable. It's so, in a way, it's like we've always known each other. There is a level of compatibility that I think is lovely and also deeply moving, considering the background.
And both your lives have kind of expanded in a way. You now have a huge family in Italy.
I have, yes. I did also have, once it was James notified all of the family in Italy that I'm here, and there was a flood of wonderful emails and, you know, correspondence from cousins and an auntie, and we had a Zoom. I had a, well, you were, yes, there too, because you were interpreting. I had you in my phone and my ear, and had a Zoom with my two cousins and auntie from Rome. And yeah, that was a little technological, you know, feat that we got through with the language barrier, because sadly I don't speak or understand Italian, but I would love to pursue that and prove that you can teach an old dog new tricks, and we'll see how that goes. But certainly being around James and Gino and James, and then being in Italy and hearing my language, which I can now start to say that is my language. To hear that sort of rain all over me, that has been really powerful. And just understanding, you know, the power of language and when languages are lost and what that means for people and generations, and when they do lose their mother tongue. So I've never, had that opportunity, but I do now.
And you were mentioning before we came into the studio that your children have also embraced this new family.
Yes, definitely.
Open-heartedly.
Yeah, they're in awe. My son, you know, is particularly fond of James and has a really strong connection. And my daughter, she's just been hanging on every word and, you know, has latched on to Louisa and latched on to James. And she, you know, has travelled to Italy twice since all of this has this news, and she's, you know, up to however many levels and Duolingo in Italian. So she's leading our way. And when I try and say some words, and she's the one that criticises me the most for getting it wrong. So,
as children do.
Yes. So it's all normal. Yeah.
You were saying before, James, that you've been particularly lucky in a way, because you found each other, but also you love being with each other.
Yes.
And you also have had, Karen, a previous experience that wasn't so lucky.
Mm.
So what would your message be for families out there that may find themselves in a similar situation? Is there like a piece of advice you feel like sharing?
I would say, you know, adoptees, we do have a right to know our family and where we've come from, our culture, where whatever that may be, is worth knowing. Be kind to yourself. And because I've had a lot of highs and some very low lows, I'm probably still a little on guard of when things are going to go wrong, you know. So I do still carry those sensitivities with me, given that, yeah, what had happened with my maternal family. Yeah, so I just let people know we, as adoptees, we do have a right to know. And I'm really looking forward to, yeah, just learning more and following some steps, getting an Italian passport, learning the language. You know, I would love to do as much as I can and to spend more time in Italy whenever I can.
Could I just add that that is something that I've only become aware of since understanding more about Karen's story, the notion that I think, like all of us, we grew up accepting that the definition of family can be broad. You can have step siblings, you can have, you know, adopted siblings, and that is the notion of family, in which, in a way, we tend to downplay the significance of a genetic connection. What Karen has reminded us of is that that genetic connection, there's nothing wrong with saying that it is important. You know, there's nothing politically incorrect about being interested in a genetic connection and placing importance on that. And finding one another and finding for an adoptee to find his or her family, his or her biological family, is important. And that is something that I hadn't thought about before, but now it's been presented to me in very stark terms, and it's something that I accept unreservedly.
Karen, Lifting the Lid tells part of your story. You're a writer. I imagine that you still process what's happening to you by writing. Mm-hmm. Are you planning to publish a new book?
I would love to do that. I've started writing. I'm just a little torn whether it's a... I mean, there's a lot more to say, and just where the book had finished, and I've received lots of really beautiful comments sent to me by readers that I've never met. So I think it was already a sort of a universal story, and I think it will become even more so. Potentially a translation in Italian would be worthwhile pursuing, and yeah, so if there are any publishers out there wanting to give me a leg up, I'd be open to that. But definitely, regardless of it, publisher or no publisher, we'll be writing the story. And, you know, it's not just me, but people do say that it is the story as it's unfolded over the years. It's quite cinematic. You know, we can imagine Gino in his VW, in his Beetle driving to Queensland, to the cane fields, like how ridiculous but how fabulous at the same time. And, and just his life and his family and James and just how it's all unfolded. And really, Gino had only come back to Melbourne in 2019.
Yes, he'd spent a long time in Hong Kong and then in Italy. So my parents sort of travelled a lot. We travelled a lot when we were younger as well. So he hadn't been back in Melbourne for very long. And yeah. So I think it was just really fortunate circumstances that Karen was in Melbourne, he was in Melbourne, I was in Melbourne, and we were able to successfully build a family.
Yep.
Many sliding doors moments, yes, in this story.
Many, many. It's fantastic.
Karen and James, thank you so much for sharing such a beautiful but intimate story. I'm humbled that you chose to come to the studio and tell it to our audience. All the best.
Thank you, Magica.
Thank you, Magica. Ciao.
And welcome to the Italian community as well, I guess.
Grazie.
Grazie.
Volete ascoltare altre storie come questa? Potete trovarle su Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify o ovunque scarichiate i vostri podcast.
I tuoi nuovi clienti stanno ascoltando questo spot pubblicitario in questo preciso momento. Cosa diresti loro della tua attività se potessi farlo? L'SBS è l'emittente più affidabile di tutta l'Australia. I nostri ascoltatori sono fedeli, altamente partecipi e da sempre sostengono una miriade di aziende locali. Fai che la tua sia la prossima. Offriamo pacchetti pubblicitari per aziende di ogni dimensione. Il nostro team esperto di vendita ti guiderà lungo il processo di una favolosa campagna pubblicitaria. Portaci tu il tuo spot oppure incarica il nostro team di produzione di realizzartene uno in una delle nostre 68 lingue. Cosa aspetti? Inizia oggi stesso la conversazione con il tuo nuovo pubblico. Email sales@sps.com.au.